Hello and a very warm welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm pleased to present the second installment in a podcast series exploring acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, sponsored by Novartis. If you missed the first episode, a fascinating summary of recent findings from the latest American Society of Hematology meeting, be sure to go and check it out now. For this, we'll be focusing on patients with AML as well as FMS-related tyrosine kinase 3 or FLT3 gene mutations. I'm passing over the hosting to the esteemed Dr. Julia Duffy, a freelance market access consultant and the Director of Medical Education Strategy for Infectious Diseases at Medscape WebMD from here in the United Kingdom. Dr. Duffy is joined by two experts in the field. First, we have Dr. Adriano Venditti, who's an Associate Professor of Hematology at the University of Rome Tor Vergata in Italy. We also have Dr. Lars Bullinger from the Department of Hematology, Oncology and Tumor Immunology at the Charité Hospital Medicine in Germany. It's a fantastic discussion from a unique panel, so please sit back, relax and enjoy.
Hi, my name's Julia Duffy, here with Professor Adrian Venditti and Professor Lars Bullinger. We're going to discuss today in this podcast the FLT3 mutations in patients with AML. Lars, please could you explain exactly what an FLT3 mutation is, please?
Hi, Julia. I'm happy to be here today, and I'm of course also happy to answer the first question or get the podcast going. In order to become a malignant cell, our blood cells, the hematopoietic stem cells, can acquire mutations when we get older. And one of these mutations is a so-called FLT3 mutation. That's a receptor tyrosine kinase, FLT3. That's a molecule the cell needs to communicate with its environment and to receive more or less stimuli from the outside that the cell has to proliferate and to divide, for example, if new blood cells are needed. And if that mutation occurs in that respective gene, the protein, the FLT3 receptor tyrosine kinase that is encoded by the gene, has a defect that it cannot be turned off anymore. And then the hematopoietic stem cells are constantly getting a signal that they should grow and proliferate, even though they do not get the stimulation from the outside anymore. And this is contributing to the pathogenesis of the disease.
Thank you, Lars. And that takes us really nicely into our next question. Adriano, could you please explain to us how the FLT3 mutation affects the disease pathogenesis of AML, please?
Hi, Julia. I'm also happy to be with you today. Hi, Lars. Well, based on what Lars explained, FLT3 mutation has a relevant role in the pathogenesis of acute myeloid leukemia. Indeed, mutations occurring in the FLT3 receptor, internal tandem duplication, or at the site of tyrosine kinase domain, are able to induce a constitutive activation of the FLT3 receptor. In other words, the FLT3 receptor is permanently activated in a way that downstream signals are transmitted, and the cells is kept in a constant state of activation in terms of proliferation and inhibition of apoptosis. That is the mechanism that can lead to the accumulation of leukemic blast in the bone marrow. So a relevant role in the pathogenesis of acute myeloid leukemia.
Perhaps I can add here that I agree with everything that Adriano said, but what we also know from studying the disease in more depth is that this is usually one of the mutations that occurs rather at a later time point. Usually you first have a mutation that leads to the transformation of the cell, that it cannot differentiate anymore in the way it should. And then you get on top such a mutation like the FLT3 mutation that provides the proliferative advantage. But very often that comes later during the evolutionary process from a normal cell developing into a malignant leukemic cell.
Yes, you're right, Lars. This is the so-called double hit hypothesis.
Thank you both. That was really interesting. Now, we all know that, unfortunately, the progress of patients with AML differs quite significantly as well. And we have touched on it a little bit about how FLT3 is associated with the latter stages of disease. But I'll go to Adriano. If you could please explain why a high allelic burden of FLT3 is associated with a particularly poor prognosis and why a low allelic burden is associated with a more favorable prognosis in patients with AML?
Yes, well, I have to say that this is something that we have a chance to learn when FLT3 inhibitors were available. Actually, at the very beginning, we had evidences that FLT3 mutations, ITD mutations, generally speaking, and regardless of the allelic burden, was associated with a poor prognosis. In a more recent time, thanks to the improved knowledges about the biology of the leukemic cells, and thanks to the availability of FLT3 inhibitors, I'm especially referring to the midostaurin experience of which was developed within the RATIFY trial. Well, based on this on this body of information, we became aware of the importance of the allelic burden. And the allelic burden actually is, let's say, a reflection of the tumor size of the tumor burden. That means, if translated in a therapeutic landscape, that means that FLT3 inhibitors, such as midostaurin, can exert a more active action against cells with low tumor burden rather than with high tumor burden. And in this context, I would like also to mention the importance of concomitant mutations. Actually, with the time, we also became aware about the role of NPM1 mutation. So we have become aware of the combination of NPM1 and FLT3 ITD mutation, and the differences in their combination can affect the prognosis.
I agree with Adriano, and perhaps I can add that, yeah, in general, FLT3, if you look at in each individual subgroup for leukemia, if you have FLT3, you do worse than without FLT3. So this is true for the NPM1 mutants, but also for the ones that do not have NPM1 mutations. And the allelic burden, I think, like Adriano pointed out, just shows you how many of the cells already have gained this high proliferative capability. And if this is the majority of the cells, then we know that they are more chemo-resistant and harder to control. And therefore, this is linked to poor outcome. And this was from the times also. I mean, many of these correlations were identified before we had the kinase inhibitors at hand, which nowadays, of course, allow us to control the disease better than before.
And Lars, could you please tell us a little bit more about why internal tandem duplications in FLT3 remain challenging to target, please?
Yeah, so if we talk about these mutations, we also always think they are all doing the same thing, but FLT3 is a large gene that encodes for this receptor tyrosine kinase, so that kinase has like a part that's outside of the cell, one that is going through the membrane, and then the intracellular part, which has the tyrosine kinase domain and which activates then the signaling pathways downstream of it. And we have learned in the past that it depends on where the mutations are located, that some of them respond better to therapy, especially those that are more located closer to the membrane, which we call the juxtamembrane domain, whereas the ones that directly affect the tyrosine kinase domain are more harder to treat. And then also these internal tandem duplications, that means that parts of the chromosome are duplicated and thereby lead to the activity, or that the cell cannot inactivate the kinase anymore. We also have learned that the longer those repeats are that are duplicated, also the more difficult it is to treat these mutations. So long story short, the label FLT3-ITD is a mixed bag of different types of mutations that all behave slightly differently. Oh, Adriano, what do you think?
Yes, I agree. I mean, as you pointed out, it's a conformational matter, and especially because of the location at the inner surface of the cell membrane. And well, in this view, I think it may be important the role of the different types of FLT3 inhibitors that we have available, that we have in our hands. I mean, we know that we have type 1 and type 2 FLT3 inhibitors. Type 1 are able to inhibit the FLT3 receptor both in activated and inactivated conformation. Type 2 are able to inhibit those receptors that are in the only in the activated conformation.
And you mentioned there therapies, and I'd like to now take it into a clinical situation, if that's possible, please. So, and I'll go to you, Adriano. So maintenance therapy, it's an evolving strategy for patients with AML. So my question is, in what clinical situations would you select maintenance therapy for patients with FLT3 mutations, and why, please?
Well, maintenance, I would say that maintenance has become a paramount, an issue of paramount importance, generally speaking, for acute myeloid leukemia. Probably this is something even more relevant for patients with FLT3 mutations. And I have to say that for patients who are not submitted to the allogeneic stem cell transplant, the RATIFY study provided us with, contradictory results. Actually, in that trial, patients are not addressed to an allogeneic stem cell transplant, treated with placebo or with midostaurin, did not show differences in terms of survival estimates. On the other hand, we have quite promising trials delivering FLT3 inhibitors, for instance, midostaurin, for instance, sorafenib, in a randomized context in patients who were submitted to an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And I have to say that although the numbers are still few, they were presented in previous such meetings, the differences are quite interesting, quite promising, favoring the maintenance, the post-allogeneic stem cell transplant maintenance. So For the time being, I believe that for the time being, and based on the results that we have available, I believe that the population of patients who are treated post-induction with an allogeneic stem cell transplant represents a good category to receive a maintenance with FLT3 inhibitors. What do you think, Lars?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Ideally, in patients treated in first-line therapy with a kinase inhibitor and a FLT3 internal tandem duplication, especially if they have a high allelic burden, they should move forward for transplant. And I think even many centers move forward to transplant with the patients that have a low allelic burden, even though there you could discuss whether this is necessary or not. It's a matter of debate, but I think in that population, if you cannot move forward for transplant or the patient does not want to move forward for transplant and you have the option of doing the maintenance therapy, I definitely would recommend it because the risk of relapse is lower in that cohort. And then I also see the second indication, as Adriano pointed out, after an allogeneic transplant. There was nice work demonstrated by Robert Zeiser's group from Freiburg showing that in that situation, the addition of the kinase inhibitor can also contribute to mitigate the immune escape mechanisms those tumor cells also have by the activation of the FLT3 kinase, and that their maintenance therapy also can prevent relapse, or even if relapse has occurred, can lead to a second or can induce remission again. So in that setting, definitely kinase inhibitor maintenance therapy is also warranted.
So this is a question to you both. What agents are in clinical trials, or what combinations of agents or regimes, you know, are currently in clinical trials or have recently been presented that you feel is really going to make a difference to patients with FLT3 mutations? So I'll pop that to you, Lars, and then Adriano, if you could comment afterwards, that'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a question where we could already do an entire podcast on. Definitely, we have the drug that is already approved in first-line therapy, midostaurin, which is a broader kinase inhibitor, which has proven its clinical utility in a large randomized phase 3 trial. Currently, our study group is comparing that kinase inhibitor in a randomized fashion in combination with classical chemotherapy with gilteritinib. So it's a head-to-head comparison, more or less. Gilteritinib is a second-generation kinase inhibitor that recently has been approved for the relapsed refractory setting. Both have some advantages and disadvantages. One is, as I said, a little more broad, might be easier to inhibit, like more or less all FLT3 or different kinds of FLT3 mutations equally well. The other one might be more specific for some specific FLT3 mutation subgroups. So long story short, I'm really looking forward to see out what comes out from this trial, whether one of the arms is better than the other or whether both do equally well. Or what I hope is that we can learn from that trial which FLT3 internal tandem duplication benefits more from one drug and which is better targeted by the other one.
Besides midostaurin, we have at least other three agents that are under investigation: gilteritinib, crenolanib, and quizartinib. Actually, these agents are being challenging in a way that they can be brought from the context of relapsed refractory AML into a frontline scenario. And just let me mention that gilteritinib is being tested head-to-head to midostaurin in a huge clinical trial that represents a huge international efforts, putting together different cooperative groups. And I think that this trial is of paramount importance because it will provide us an answer not only in regards to the comparison between midostaurin and gilteritinib, but also in terms of role of FLT3 inhibitors as a maintenance after chemotherapy or after allogeneic stem cell transplant. And crenolanib also is being tested in randomized trials, first line and refractory relapsed acute myeloid leukemia. And I think we are also eager to look at the final results of the Quantum First study. This is a study randomizing patients with FLT3 mutated AML to chemotherapy alone or chemotherapy plus placebo versus chemotherapy plus quizartinib. And I think this is an important trial. We know the unfortunate history of quizartinib that was not approved by FDA when tested in refractory or relapsed patients. But we are eager to look at the results of this first line approach. And finally, just let me mention the importance of measurable residual disease detection. As a GMEMA group, we have a trial ongoing that is called AML1919 for FLT3 positive patients. In this trial, we want to test at very early time points the role of minimal residual disease in the peripheral blood under treatment, including midostaurin and chemotherapy. So I think a lot of stuff to manage. These are very exciting times.
Yeah, I fully agree, especially with regard to minimal residual disease measurement. I think this will become more and more important, especially if we think of course also of patients treated with these kinase inhibitors as a maintenance therapy. And there is also very promising data showing that, I mean, if there is resistant clones coming up, that we could even switch the kinase inhibitor therapy because they act differently, that some mutations might be then resistant to one of the kinase inhibitors, but nevertheless respond to the other one. So like similar management like we have for chronic myelogenous leukemia already today. I think there we will really have to learn a lot in the future still, but I'm completely in line with Adriano that it's exciting times.
You've both touched on the measurement of minimal residual disease. Now, I'd like to take that a step further, please. So how will next generation sequencing impact the approach to management of patients with AML and FLT3 mutation?
Yeah, I mean, with this new technology, we now cannot only monitor one mutation anymore at a time, but the tests are developing in a way that we can use, hopefully in the future, one test at the beginning for making the diagnosis and to capture all the mutations the tumor is having, especially like, for example, the FLT3 internal tandem duplications, and that we then can use the same test to follow up the patient and identify the emergence, for example, of resistant subclones. In the past, it was always a little difficult to identify these large internal tandem duplications with shotgun sequencing, because with shotgun sequencing, you generate reads that are 300 base pairs long, and if the internal tandem duplication is too big, you cannot align the reads anymore. But there we and others have identified also tests that you now can use to get an unbiased measurement also for these internal tandem duplications. And I think while this is still used in clinical trials and experimental few years down the road, this will be the standard of care, and then we will use the new technology to monitor the disease.
Adriano, what are your thoughts on next generation sequencing?
Well, you probably know that when it comes to measurable residual disease as a surrogate endpoint, FDA asked for an NGS approach. So NGS promises to be the future. For instance, we are working hard within the European Leukemia Net, within the Harmony project, to address as better as possible the issue of measurable residual disease. I'm not an expert, but for the time being, I believe that there are some technical issues still pending that need to be solved and to be addressed. But I believe that NGS will be the future due to its sensitivity and the ability to pick up even small clones that can be present. In this view, I have a question for Lars, who is the expert. I think that can happen that you deal with a patient who is FLT3 negative using conventional approaches, but can shows the presence of small subclones using NGS. So, Lars, in your opinion, what is the role to assign in this situation to such a positivity, and what is your suggestion from a clinical point of view? I mean, are you going to treat these patients as an FLT3 mutated or not? In other words, my question is, how much in depth should we descend to have useful clinical information?
Yeah, that's a very important question you're asking, and also a very difficult one to answer. Definitely there are these cases where you have these small subclones where you can detect something with next generation sequencing, but you might have missed it, for example, with a conventional gene scan based approach. To be honest, the clinical importance of these is still not really well defined. You already alluded to these large European efforts where we all work together, put the data together, like the Harmony Alliance. And I think this is what we need in the future, put the data together that we more quickly can learn from these cases and identify their clinical impact. But I think in the future, we also might take care of these high-risk subclones that are present at the time of diagnosis, or at least watch them carefully and then react when we see that they start to create a problem.
Thank you, Lars. Now, what I'd like to do to conclude is both of you, if you could look into your crystal ball and for me predict, in 5 years' time, what do you think the clinical landscape will look like, please?
Well, as mentioned before, these are very exciting times. We have so many different agents in development, and from the patient's side, I think this is an important news because we have tools in our hands to treat effectively these patients. And what I expect is that these new agents are soon brought into the first line context, and based on the results of the ongoing randomized trials, I hope that these agents are soon available to our patients, with FLT3 mutated patients. AML, sorry. Of course, we have a number of questions left on the carpet. For instance, maintenance, maintenance after chemo, maintenance after allogeneic stem cell transplant. And finally, I would mention again the importance of measurable residual disease. I mean, whatever the technique that we intend to use, I think that measurable residual disease is can really represent, together with the genetic pattern of the acute myeloid leukemia we are dealing with, can really represent a sort of driver, help defining our post remission approaches.
I'm completely in line with Adriano's crystal ball. I think we will see more molecular diagnostics in the future that allow us to better treat the patients on their individual risk. And I think what in the future also will change, I think where the road may lead us is that we will see new combinatorial treatments with all these new exciting drugs that are out on the horizon, that we then also combine the FLT3 inhibition maintenance therapy, for example, with a demethylating agent maintenance therapy, and in that way might further decrease the risk of relapse, or even include then these new promising immune oncological treatment approaches, for example, also antibodies targeting, like, for example, the CD47 antigen. And I think that the combination of things, the kinase inhibitor to stop the proliferative advantage of the cell and prevent them from their immune mechanisms linked with the other new treatment approaches, that this will help us to cure more and more patients in the future.
Well, I'd like to conclude the podcast there. And Adriano and Lars, thank you so, so much for that really wonderful insight into the FLT3 mutations and the clinical perspectives of those. So thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you both today.
Thanks also from my side.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for this invitation.
Well, that concludes another insightful and revealing podcast on AML. Thank you to Dr. Julia Duffy for leading the discussion, and to our two key opinion leaders, Dr. Adriano Venditti and Dr. Lars Bullinger, for their time and insight. If you like this episode, please don't forget to subscribe. We have new episodes of the EMG Health Podcast each Friday, so be sure to tune in again. That's it for this week. Please take care. Bye for now.